Good evening, it's Saturday, September 5th, 2020. Coming up, as tension around the forthcoming presidential election remains high, RefuseFascism.org launches a 60-day struggle calling for an end to the Trump-Pence administration.
And they should vote and vote against Trump, but they also have to be in the streets showing in a determined way that we refuse to accept this.
Professors across the country prepare to participate in a strike for scholars.
Black social protests have really informed the ways in which democracy is essential and what it could look like in this country. It's something that I feel like is an important gift that Black lives have given to this country and to me.
And the East Bay Democratic Socialists of America organized a car caravan to raise support for Proposition 15.
Prop 15 campaign estimates that some 92% of the revenues that would be raised by Proposition 15 will come from just 10% of the commercial property owners in California.
With David Rosenberg, I'm Sharon Sabota, and this is the KPFA Weekend Evening News. On the heels of Labor Day, many professors and scholars in colleges and universities across the country and in Canada will be participating in a scholar strike for racial justice. That's happening between September 8th and 9th. Over the past several summers, as professors have finalized their syllabi in hopes of informing minds and touching hearts, the deaths of Eric Garner, Mike Brown, Sandra Bland, Alton Sterling, Philando Castile, and George Floyd, and the paralyzing injury of Jacob Blake, who was shot 7 times this summer in Kenosha, Wisconsin, along with many others, have amplified the need to address racial injustice, both outside and inside the classroom. Michael Viola is an associate professor of justice, community, and leadership, and a member of the Ethnic Studies faculty at St. Mary's College of California. Viola says he'll be participating in the strike not only to honor the Black lives that have been lost, but also to honor the academic labor of Black scholars and struggles of Black students.
Growing up in California, I was politicized by hip-hop music. Black youth played a central part in creating that form of cultural production. And then the insights of Black scholars from Du Bois to Manning Marable to Cornel West, the Kambahi Collective, River Collective, they all helped to shape the way in which I understand the world as a Filipino American, not only intellectually, but also in terms of like the ways in which Black social protests have really informed the ways in which democracy is essential and what it could look like in this country is something that I feel like is an important gift that Black lives have given to this country and to me. I think it's important to recognize that labor, those gifts that have been offered from Black lives that have enabled me as a Filipino American immigrant who occupies a position in the academy, like that is because of the struggles that were fought out by Black youth, Black activists, Black cultural workers in solidarity with so many other white allies, Filipino Americans, and people of color. My ability to be able to be at an institution of higher learning and to have the privilege of teaching here is on the backs of those historic struggles, and that history is still ongoing in our present moment.
Viola says in spite of the difficult times that the country is facing, he remains optimistic.
And what brings me hope is that our communities are struggling. My students are asking some really important questions about the various ways in which they can participate in these movements, the ways in which they can direct their labor. Again, this is a strike that's happening right after Labor Day, where they are thinking about the, like, not only what is it that they can critique, but also the ways in which they can think about their labor in terms of what is it that they can create to also support the creation of another world.
That's Michael Viola, a professor of justice, community, and leadership and ethnic studies at St. Mary's College, speaking about the scholar strike for racial justice.
Some historians have argued that in order to understand the current situation between police departments and African-American communities across the country, you have to go back a long ways. Gerald Horn is the Morris Professor of History and African-American Studies at the University of Houston. His latest book is The Dawning of the Apocalypse, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, Settler Colonialism, and Capitalism in the Long 16th Century. We asked him what slavery and the settler colonial mentality had to do with the police abuse of Black communities that's still going on to this day.
To understand what we're seeing in the streets in Kenosha, in Staten Island, in Minneapolis with George Floyd, et cetera, you really have to rethink the entire process of settler colonialism, a term curiously and conspicuously absent from the vocabulary of even those who consider themselves to be radical. And you have to understand the tangled roots of religious infected racism.
Where do we go from here to untangle that kind of mess?
There are many routes. One, having an adequate and accurate analysis would help. That would keep us from being surprised. That would keep us from being shocked by the fact that as of today, there's no guarantee that the oath in the Oval Office, the Manhattan Mussolini, will be defeated on the first Tuesday in November 2020. So having an adequate analysis of the history will go a long way in terms of helping us to devise prescriptions. Secondly, if you try to understand how Black people in particular were able to dig ourselves out of the deep hole in which we have found ourselves, you have to understand the international situation. You have to understand the Haitian Revolution, 1791 to 1804, that led to a general crisis in the entire slave system that egged London to move away from the slave trade, which it did in 1807, and from slavery, which it did in 1833, and then develop an alliance with revolutionary Haiti to put pressure on the United States, culminating in the U.S. Civil War, 1861, and abolition of slavery by 1865. And then the Cold War, of course, where Washington finds it difficult to portray itself as a paragon of human rights virtue in the competition with the then socialist camp, as long as people of color were treated so atrociously, and as long as the Soviet Union was arming liberation movements in Africa. And that creates momentum and pressure for the United States to move away from the more egregious aspects of Jim Crow.
That's University of Houston professor Gerald Horn. Schools across the nation are beginning the new academic year with continued reliance on online educational technologies. Some educators believe that over-reliance and misuse of those technologies can cause problems. The California Alliance of Researchers for Equity in Education recently released a brief concerning the shift to online education. Ruchi Rangnath is an assistant professor at the University of San Francisco and the faculty coordinator for the South Bay Masters in Arts and Technology Credential Program. She talked about the problems associated with online education.
As an educator, as a parent of young children, a first grader and second grader, and also now a teacher educator, it's a really difficult moment. You know, I feel that everyone is trying to do the best they can and make it work, but it is really very challenging on so many different levels.
What do you think it means for education? Is there going to be a substantial difference in the way people learn? Is the technology going to make a difference one way or the other?
You know, technology, the way that I see it, it can be very helpful in many ways. It can enhance the learning of our children. But what we've written about in this CARE.ed brief, which is a California Alliance of Researchers in Education, FUES came together to really look at the research around online teaching and really look at the advantages and disadvantages. But what the research is saying, and there's not a lot out there because this is all so new, but as more and more is coming up, it's really the harmful effects of learning, right? We see already resources around connectivity, whether it's hardware or internet, whether it's familiarity with navigating these sort of technologies for online education. Even as an educator and a mom, I really struggle sometimes with helping my children stay organized, stay focused. A lot of the pieces we see, also the negative extensive screen time. A lot of kids are online for 8 hours. And this is really intensifying issues around mental health like ADHD and screen addiction, aggression, depression, anxiety. So I think that thinking about online and this moment, it's really complex. It has a lot of contradictions. And it's really, you know, as public school leaders and educators and parents and families, really grappling with these difficult decisions of what it should look like and how it should be implemented.
That's University of San Francisco Assistant Professor Ruchi Rangnath.
This year, many Americans are welcoming the long Labor Day weekend with some uncertainty about the future. Many Americans and workers are dealing with challenges from the global pandemic, which has left them feeling powerless. This Labor Day, the East Bay Democratic Socialists of America are organizing a Labor Day car caravan to support Proposition 15. The group says it's a chance for working people to take control back from the rich. KPFA's Lola Akamu reports.
This Labor Day, the rising temperatures are not going to keep the East Bay Democratic Socialists from making their voices heard. The socialist group is working to build a progressive movement that they hope will lead the way to making major changes in the country. They are organizing a car caravan throughout various East Bay cities on Monday to call for support for Proposition 15. The event will feature speakers, educators, and candidates running for political office. Prop 15 is a statewide measure on the November ballot that will raise business property taxes based on current market value to fund education and local government initiatives. Fred Gloss is a member of DSA. He says the ballot measure is good for the state and will help to reduce inequities in property taxes.
Proposition 15 will close a corporate tax loophole that allows large owners of commercial property to get away with not paying their fair share of taxes to support schools and services. Prop 15 campaign estimates that some 92% of the revenues that would be raised by Proposition 15 will come from just 10% of the commercial property owners in California. This speaks to the concentration of wealth in this state and growing economic inequality represented by that ownership. And Prop 15 would go a long way, but it's a good start toward helping to reduce the inequities in property taxes, revenues, and therefore the economics of the state.
Opponents of the measure say the measure will increase the cost of living for Californians, especially for small businesses and families who they say will bear the burden. Gloss says the global pandemic has created a financial burden for the state, but that the proposition is going to help with the state budget.
So beginning in 1978 with Proposition 13, property taxes in the state were set at 1% of assessed value. This would reset property taxes at market rate. It still would be 1%, but it would be 1% of market rate now, not 1% of market rate in 1978 or whenever the property was purchased. By this simple move, the state would receive $10 to $12 billion a year for schools and services. So this was meant to be something to help schools and services be better than they were before the pandemic. Now that we've had the pandemic and the depression, this is all the more crucial as it's going to fill at least part of the budget hole that has opened up in the state since the pandemic.
Again, that was Fred Gloss with the East Bay Democratic Socialists of America. The event starts at 10 and will follow social distancing protocol. To learn more, you can visit the DSA website at dsausa.org. I'm Lola Kumu, reporting for KPFA News.
Today, RefuseFascism.org held a nationwide protest to launch 60 Days of Struggle. With the presidential election just 2 months away, Refuse Fascism organizers say it's imperative that people across the country take to the streets and speak out against Trump's efforts to undermine the election process by illegally encouraging voters to vote twice in some states and inserting obstacles that they say amount to efforts to suppress black and brown votes. Carl Dix is with RefuseFascism.org and has been a part of the organization's ongoing call to stop the Trump-Pence administration.
Again and again, the tens of millions of people who hate what Donald Trump and his regime represent have looked to the channels of the system to deal with it, be that the Mueller report, be that the midterms, be that impeachment. And we have seen that they have just barreled through all of those. Now people are looking to the elections. And look, I'm 72 years old. I have never voted in a presidential election because it's the system's elections. Well, this time, the Revolutionary Communist Party has changed its position on this. We are advocating that people vote against Trump by voting for Biden as part of the nonviolent means to get rid of this system. But we also say to people, don't rely on the elections.
Dick says that while voting is particularly imperative this election, it is not enough.
When you look at what Trump's doing, he's telling you that if people get to vote by mail, this is going to be massive fraud and a rigged election. They're moving post office boxes from neighborhoods where they think the people who live there won't vote for Trump. One state sent out hundreds of thousands of mail-in ballots. A federal court ruled that those ballots were invalid. And the point being, they don't want people to have mail-in ballots. They want people to have to be like, do I want to vote against Trump enough to risk catching coronavirus? This is how far they're going on this. So we have to get people mobilized and organized, and they should vote and vote against Trump, but they also have to be in the streets showing in a determined way that we refuse to accept this, so that as the fascists are trying to figure out how to stay in power, they have to do it in the face of a mobilized and organized people.
That's Carl Dix with RefuseFascism.org. You're listening to the Weekend Evening News on KPFA 94.1 FM in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and K248BR in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. With David Rosenberg, I'm Sharon Sabota.
Restaurant workers have been among those hardest hit by the coronavirus pandemic. Saru Jeremiah is a professor at UC Berkeley's Goldman School of Public Policy and the president of One Fair Wage. She says that many service workers throughout the country are being denied unemployment insurance because their wages are too low to qualify. But she says the situation in California is a little different.
Because everybody in California gets a full minimum wage with tips on top. But tips did create a problem nevertheless. In California, tips are very fluctuating, have been hard to calculate and report. They're very messy. So in many instances in California, workers still had a really hard time accessing unemployment insurance. And for tipped workers, they still had a hard time really getting a true value of their income with regard to accessing their full benefits, because often tips go underreported or unreported. So huge problems for workers accessing unemployment insurance at the state level. For many workers, the federal dollars, that federal $600 a week, was their only source of relief, but it came very late. Often they were unable to access it because it had to come through the state system, which was not set up to process the number of workers who needed help. In fact, it was set up with just the opposite intention in mind. If you know anything about the history of the unemployment insurance system, it was set up intentionally to deny workers access so that workers would be willing to take any low-wage job that came their way.
Could you talk about the racial and gender breakdown in the industry? How much worse is it for people of color?
Sadly, these were statistics that were part of what I like to call the nation's pre-existing condition. We had a pre-existing condition as a country that was revealed with the pandemic. That pre-existing condition of racism and sexism and just very, very deep income inequality that was very related and intersectional with race and gender inequality. In the restaurant industry, we see very, very severe segregation. Before the pandemic, we had documented the fact that workers of color were segregated into lower paying segments of the industry. They were in fast food and casual restaurants rather than fine dining, and lower paying positions. So even if they weren't fine dining, they were kitchen staff and bussers and runners rather than wait staff. And the sad part to me was that even among progressives in our industry, the solution in their minds was therefore to try to, for example, equalize pay between front and back, which is an important solution, but there was very little thinking about, well, why couldn't people of color actually work in the front of the house as servers and bartenders and fine dining professionals? Why couldn't they move from a casual restaurant or fast food restaurant into a fine dining restaurant?
That's Saru Jeremiah of One Fair Wage.
This week, Fossil Free California released a report revealing how the largest U.S. teachers' pension fund's climate policies reform are related to climate science and financial returns. Fossil Free California is an organization of California residents active in local 350.org climate groups and allied environmental organizations that work to end financial support for climate-damaging fossil fuels and to promote a just transition to a low-carbon economy. KPFA's Diana Capcabin reports.
CalSTRS is the second largest pension fund in the United States and is entrusted with the retirement savings of almost 1 million public school teachers. It currently has $6 billion invested in the fossil fuel industry.
Unions representing over 142,000 teachers have already signed resolutions urging CalSTRS to divest from fossil fuels. CalSTRS Climate Competence Report Card looks at how the Teachers Retirement Fund has done on its investments in fossil fuels.
Fossil Free California says that CalSTRS still fails in 4 out of 5 areas of climate competence. Iman is a youth activist with Earth Guardians Bay Area crew who lives in Richmond. He says he did some research and came to this conclusion from CalSTRS recent meetings.
And there are two main reasons that why they don't want to divest, and it's also something that they've kept telling us, was that, first of all, they would lose money if they divested from fossil fuels to the Teachers Retirement Fund. And that actually doesn't make sense because fossil fuels isn't a stable platform anymore. It is losing revenue. Green energy is making a lot more revenue, and it's honestly a better financial choice to choose. And the other thing that they told us was that if we divested, then what would have happened was they wouldn't be able to shape corporate behavior for long-term sustainable growth. And that basically means that if we don't divest in them and we fund them, then we can tell them to be more green, which it really just doesn't make any sense.
CalSTRS earned an F grade in 3 areas: fossil fuel company investments, review of exposure to climate risk, and engagement with fossil fuel corporations. And despite losing $270 million in ExxonMobil stock from July 2019 to May 2020, CalSTRS remained invested. Exxon was recently dumped from the Dow Jones Industrial Average and faces climate-related lawsuits in 3 states and in 8 California municipalities. CalSTRS does not follow California law SB 964, which mandates review of exposure to climate risk. Its investments do not reflect the Paris Climate Agreement goals. Cynthia Kaufman is a member of Fossil Fuel California and says CalSTRS is losing a lot of money and not having an impact on the fossil fuel companies.
They're still very invested in coal. They recently did an analysis of their exposure to climate risk and based the analysis on a 4 degrees centigrade global warming, a level of global warming, which is completely catastrophic for the human species. So they're just all kinds of things that they're doing that really show that they do a lot of greenwashing.
Fossil Free California says CalSTRS has failed to change its behavior. So fossil fuel investments are increasingly in danger of being stranded assets or unfunded liabilities. Kaufman explains the impact of what CalSTRS does.
By being invested in fossil fuels, they're helping enable the perpetuation of that industry, which is destroying the planet. We need everybody to shun that industry and get away from it as quickly as possible.
Diana Capcabin reporting. For a third day, rescue workers continue to dig through the rubble of a Beirut building, still hoping to find someone alive more than a month after a massive port explosion shattered Lebanon's capital. About 50 rescue workers and volunteers, including a specialist team from Chile, have not yet located anyone. Earlier in the week, sensors detected signs of breathing and heat. The blast killed about 190 people, injured 6,000 more, and devastated whole neighborhoods. On Friday, ceremonies were held to mark a month since the explosion tore into a city already suffering from a serious economic crisis.
Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro has come in for his share of criticism for the way he's handled the coronavirus, in large part because of the way poor communities in the country have been affected. Natalia de Campos is a performance artist and activist and one of the co-founders of the Defend Democracy in Brazil Committee. She talked about the situation in Brazil.
Brazil is as big as, you know, or just as big comparatively to the United States. We have 260 million people in a smaller area than the United States. So they're very different communities. In the urban areas, I think people are struggling a lot with job, you know, loss, and also with the effects of the pandemic itself in terms of not being able to work and or getting sick and losing relatives. And so the government of Bolsonaro said that they were going to do some financial aid to the small, you know, the poorest populations earlier in the pandemic. They were supposed to give to the lowest income population about 600 reais, which is 120 $30 a month, not like in the US where you get $600 a week, 600 reais a month, which is very, very small, and it's lower than the minimum wage there, which is about 1500 reais. And so that's very little out of a help. And it was very slow in coming. It took several months to get people receiving that support.
What's the situation in the hospitals? Are they able to handle all the patients who show up there?
So in the cities, I think some cities got really overwhelmed. São Paulo, for example, was one of the early ones that built some extra support, some temporary hospitals. But I think they really got overwhelmed. What I hear from professionals, health professionals that are friends of ours and activists as well, is that they didn't have the equipment that they needed. So they got overwhelmed, and some universities started building their own equipment, their own respirators, but it didn't reach all parts of the country. The health minister was ousted, and then a new one took place, and that one resigned. All this in the middle of the pandemic, right? From March to May, we had three health ministers. And the current one that took over in May is not a health minister. He's an interim general of the army that stepped in as an interim health minister. And so he is not experienced, and they are not consulting with epidemiologists on how to combat the virus. And so some regions, some governors starting importing supplies directly from China, especially in the north of the country, which is a more left-leaning governments like Maranhão in the Amazon. And they start to then become, you know, start a war with Bolsonaro, basically.
That's Natalia de Campos of the Defend Democracy in Brazil Committee.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan today warned Greece to enter talks over disputed territorial claims or face the consequences. Turkey is currently facing off against Greece and Cyprus over oil and gas exploration rights in the eastern Mediterranean. All the parties involved have deployed naval and air forces to assert their competing claims in the region. Erdogan said that Turkey has the political, economic, and military power to tear up what he called the immoral maps and documents imposed on his country. Greece and Cyprus consider the area in dispute as their economic maritime zones. And the weather. There's an excessive heat warning in effect for both the San Francisco Bay Area and the San Joaquin Central Valley, with highs ranging from the 80s to the lower 100s. Remember to stay hydrated and take it easy when outdoors. That's it for this evening's news. Thanks to Lola Okamu and Diana Kepcabin for helping to prepare tonight's news. Carla West is at the controls. With David Rosenberg, I'm Sharon Sabota. Good evening.